Welcome to the American Military History Podcast. I'm your host, Justin, and this is episode 30, The Battle of Valcour Island. This will be part 27 of our series on the Revolutionary War. We ended last week's episode in the first part of January of 1777, where George Washington was bringing his army into camp for winter in Morristown, New Jersey, and that was shortly after he defeated General Mawhood at the Battle of Princeton. In today's episode, we're going to turn our attention a little further north towards New York and Canada, and to our old friend Benedict Arnold, whom we last left injured with a shattered leg that he had earned in the Siege of Quebec. Now, we're going to start a series here where we talk about two battles that involved Benedict Arnold, today and next week. And today's battle actually takes place about 2 months prior to Washington crossing the Delaware. Washington crossed the Delaware at the end of December, and this battle takes place in October. Next week's battle will take place in April of 1777, which will put it after the Battle of Princeton that we just talked about. So we're going to shift around in time a little bit. But don't worry, I'll let you know when and where things are happening. The last we have heard of Benedict Arnold, at least on our podcast, was in December of 1775. He was injured in the Battle of Quebec. His leg was injured. It pretty much shattered. He had a broken leg. And after he was injured, he stayed in Quebec, and he recovered in a makeshift hospital that had been set up in the Hotel Dieu. And he enjoyed his recent promotion to Brigadier General for his actions in Quebec. But while he was recovering, he also oversaw an ongoing but an ineffective siege of the city of Quebec until he was relieved of command of that siege by Major General David Wooster in April of 1776. Arnold then traveled to Montreal, where he served as military commander of the city until forced to retreat by an advancing British army that had arrived in Quebec in May. He presided over the rear of the Continental Army during its retreat from St. John, where he was reported by James Wilkinson to be the last person to leave before the British arrived. As the American forces are retreating towards the south, Quebec's governor Guy Carleton has launched his own offensive, and that offensive has the intention of reaching the Hudson River, where you can actually start to navigate the river beginning south of Lake Champlain, and then the river extends down to New York City. Now, controlling this upper portion of the Hudson would enable the British to link their forces in Quebec with those in New York. And New York had been recently captured by Major General William Howe, and we talked about some of those battles when we were talking about the Battle of Harlem Heights and the Battle of Long Island a few episodes back. Now, if this strategy were successful, it would separate the American colonies of New England from those further south, and it would potentially quash the rebellion. And this is exactly what the Continental Congress was worried about when they had sent Arnold up to take a look at Fort Ticonderoga and go into Canada and check on Quebec and Montreal. Standing between the British Army under the command of Carleton and Benedict Arnold's forces was Lake Champlain. Lake Champlain is a long, relatively narrow lake. It's about 120 miles long, 12 miles wide at the widest point. And it's got over 550 miles of shoreline because it has a lot of bays and inlets and tributaries. tributaries, I think, come off a river, but you guys get what I'm talking about. Now, the lake is relatively shallow. It has an average depth of 64 feet. On the southern end of the lake, there's a point where you can leave the lake and then start traversing down the Hudson River. At that point sits two American forts, Fort Crown Point and Fort Ticonderoga. Now, the British understood that they had to capture these forts to proceed down the Hudson, but the forces that they had were not able to travel overland to reach them. The roads in the area were either impassable or non-existent, and that basically meant that water transport on the lake was the only viable option. However, the only ships on the lake were a small fleet of lightly armed ships that Benedict Arnold had assembled following the capture of Fort Ticonderoga all the way back in May of 1775. And even if the British managed to capture all those boats, it would still be too small to transport their forces to Fort Ticonderoga. So the two sides instantly begin this arm race. They both sit down on either sides of the lake, and they start building fleets. The British are sitting at St. John, and the Americans are on the other end of the lake in Skenesboro, which is near present-day Whitehall, New York. Now, what's interesting here is that General Carleton had actually anticipated that this problem would happen. He knew that there would be issues with transportation on Lake Champlain all the way back when he was planning for the defense of Quebec in 1775, earlier in 1775. And he had actually requested the provisioning of prefabricated ships from Europe. And this is exactly what it sounds like, just like we have prefabricated homes or buildings today. You know, it comes in sections, you follow the instructions, and you put it together. It goes together a lot faster than building it from scratch. And by the time Carleton's army had reached St. John, 10 prefabricated ships had arrived. These ships, and several others, were assembled by skilled shipwrights on the upper Richelieu River. And also assembled there was the HMS Inflexible, a 180-ton warship they disassembled at Quebec City and transported it upriver in pieces. In total, the British fleet consisted of 25 armed vessels and had more firepower than the Americans' 15 vessels, with more than 80 guns outweighing the 74 smaller American guns. Two of Carleton's ships, the Inflexible and the HMS Thunderer, just by themselves, outgunned the combined firepower of the American fleet. In addition to the Inflexible and the Thunderer, the fleet included the schooners Maria, Carleton, and Loyal Convert, and 20 single-masted gunboats, each armed with two cannons. The American generals, leading their shipbuilding effort, encountered a variety of challenges. Being a shipwright was not a common occupation in what was pretty much wilderness of upstate New York, and the Continental Navy had to pay extremely high wages to lure skilled craftsmen away from the coast. The carpenters hired to build boats on Lake Champlain were the best-paid employees of the Navy. By the end of July, there were more than 200 shipwrights at Skenesboro. In addition to skilled help, materials and supplies specific to maritime use needed to be brought to Skenesboro, where the ships were constructed, or Fort Ticonderoga, where they were fitted out for use. Now, at Skenesboro, all of the shipbuilding was overseen by a man named Hermanus Schuller, and the outfitting was managed by military engineer Jeduthun Baldwin. Schuller began work in April to produce boats larger and more suitable for combat than the small, shallow-draft bateaux that were used for transport on the lake. The process eventually came to involve Benedict Arnold, who was an experienced ship captain. If you remember before the war, that's what he did. He was involved in shipping and sailing. And David Waterbury, a Connecticut militia leader who had maritime experience. Major General Horatio Gates, in charge of the entire shipbuilding effort, eventually asked Arnold to take more responsibility in the effort, because as Gates said, speaking of himself, "I am entirely uninformed as to marine affairs." Arnold was excited to take up the task, and Gates rewarded him with command of the fleet, and Gates wrote that Arnold has a perfect knowledge in maritime affairs and is, besides, a most gallant and deserving officer. The American shipbuilding was hit by another challenge in mid-August when an outbreak of a fever among the shipwrights pretty much crippled production. And while both sides were busying themselves with shipbuilding, the growing American fleet patrolled the waters of Lake Champlain. So as they would get more and more boats, they would start putting them out on the lake. It's a way to kind of claim the territory and, you know, fighting on waters similar to fighting on land, you need position. So they're kind of scouting out the best positions to be in. And whether you like him or not, Arnold was a smart guy, and he had spent many years before the war sailing ships to Europe and the West Indies, so he knew the water, he knew how to work ships. So he spent a lot of time choosing the site where he wanted to meet the British fleet. He would eventually receive intelligence that would let him know that the British had a force significantly more powerful than his. That led him to choose a narrow, rocky body of water between the western shore of Lake Champlain and Valcour Island, where the British fleet would not be able to bring its firepower to bear. It's kind of a narrow strait, so they wouldn't be able to line all of their boats up to go broadside against them. Arnold was also dealing with the fact that he had a lot of unskilled sailors, and they weren't as good of seamen as the British sailors were. So he's trying to negate that fact by making them have to sail as little as possible. And some of his captains actually wanted to fight in open waters where they could have the possibility to retreat to the shelter of Fort Crown Point. But Arnold basically looked at him and said, hey, the purpose of this fleet was not to survive, but to delay the British advance on Crown Point and Ticonderoga until the following spring. At one point in August, Arnold sailed part of the fleet to the northernmost end of the lake, which was within 20 miles of St. John, where the British were assembled, and he formed a battle line with his boats. A British outpost, which was well out of range, actually fired a few shots at the line without effect. And on September 30th, expecting the British to sail soon, Arnold retreated to the shelter of Valcour Island. And during his patrols of the lake, Arnold had commanded the fleet from the schooner Royal Savage, carrying 12 guns and captained by David Hawley. However, as the time for battle grew closer, Arnold transferred his flag to the Congress. It's the name of the ship, not the Continental Congress. Other ships in the fleet included Revenge and Liberty, which were two-masted schooners carrying 8 guns, as well as Enterprise, a sloop which had 12 guns, and 8 gundalows, which were outfitted as gunboats, and each of these had 3 guns. Those 8 boats were the New Haven, the Providence, the Boston, the Spitfire, the Philadelphia, the Connecticut, the Jersey, and the New York. There is a cutter named the Lee, and there were row galleys, the Trumbull and Washington. Carleton's fleet was commanded by Captain Thomas Pringle, and it included 50 unarmed support vessels. And he set sail with that fleet onto Lake Champlain on October 9th. And they moved southward cautiously, and they were searching for signs of Arnold's fleet. They knew Arnold had something because they had seen it just a few weeks ago when their outpost had fired at it. On the night of October 10th, the fleet anchored about 15 miles to the north of Arnold's position, still unaware of his exact location. The next day, the 11th, they continued to sail south, assisted by favorable winds, and after they passed the northern tip of Valcour Island, Arnold sent out the Congress and the Royal Savage to draw the attention of the British. And there was a small, inconsequential exchange of fire, and the two ships tried to return to Arnold's firing line. However, when they did, the Royal Savage was unable to fight the headwinds, and she ran aground on the southern tip of Valcour Island. And when this happened, there was a group of British gunboats that just swarmed towards her, and Captain Hawley and his men hastily abandoned ship. Men from the British vessel, the Loyal Convert, boarded her, captured 20 men in the process, but were then forced to abandon her under heavy fire from the Americans. Many of Arnold's papers were lost with the destruction of the Royal Savage, which was burned by the British. He was actually in process of transferring his command when they captured it. And the loss of these papers, and this is a 30-second version of this story, we'll get into this more later, would cause Congress to state that Benedict Arnold owed them money, and these papers apparently contained receipts. And that was one of the final straws that would help lead to Arnold's defection. But again, that's a huge, huge overview and simplification of that story. We'll talk more about that another day. The British gunboats and the Carleton, the ship, not the person, maneuvered within range of the American line. The Thunderer and the HMS Maria were unable to make headway against the winds and didn't participate in the battle. Now, the Inflexible eventually came far enough up the strait to participate in the action. Around 12:30 p.m., the battle began in earnest, with both sides firing broadsides and cannonades at each other, and that continued all afternoon. The Revenge was heavily hit, the Philadelphia was also heavily damaged and eventually sank around 6:30 that night. The Carleton, the ship, not the person, whose guns wrought havoc against the smaller American gundalows, became a focus of attention, and a lucky shot eventually snapped the line holding her broadside in position, and she was seriously damaged before she could be towed out of range of the American line. The casualties on the Carleton were significant. 8 men were killed, and another 8 were wounded. Another lucky American shot hit a British gunboat's magazine, and the vessel exploded. Towards sunset, the Inflexible finally reached the action. Her big guns quickly silenced most of Arnold's fleet. When that happened, they began to push forward, and they started landing Native Americans on both Valcour Island and on the shore around the lake, and this was to deny the Americans the possibility of retreating to land. As darkness fell, the American fleet retreated, and the British called off the attack, in part because some boats had run out of ammunition. Lieutenant James Haddon, commanding one of the British gunboats, noted that, quote, little more than one-third of the British fleet saw much action that day. When the sun set on October 11th, the battle had clearly gone against the Americans. Most of the American ships were damaged or sinking, and the crews reported around 60 casualties. The British reported around 40 casualties on their ships. At this point, Arnold knows that he can't defeat the British fleet. It's just not going to happen. So he decides to try reaching the cover of Fort Crown Point, about 35 miles to the south. And it does seem a little contradictory to his statement earlier about surviving versus delaying the fleet, but at this point, he has caused a delay in the fleet. So under the cover of dark and a foggy night, the fleet, with muffled oars and minimal illumination, they kind of thread the gap of about, it's a 1 mile gap between the British ships and the western shore, where there are Native Americans on the shore with campfires burning, and the British were in their ships, so it's very much a stressful situation as these guys are kind of just slip through the line. And by morning, they had reached Schuyler Island, which is about 8 miles away from where they were. Carleton, the person, not the boat, upset that the Americans had escaped him, immediately sent his fleet around Valcour Island to find them. And realizing the Americans were not there, he regrouped his fleet and sent scouts out to find Arnold. Adverse winds, as well as damaged and leaky boats, slowed the American fleet's progress. At Schuyler Island, the Providence and Jersey were sunk and burned, and crude repairs were effected to other vessels. The cutter Lee was also abandoned on the western shore and eventually taken by the British. Around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the fleet sailed again, trying to make headway against biting winds, rain, and sleet. By the following morning, the ships were still more than 20 miles from Crown Point, and the British fleet's masts were visible on the horizon. When the wind finally changed, the British had its advantage first. They closed once again, opening fire on the Congress and Washington, which were in the rear of the American fleet. Now, Arnold first decided to attempt grounding the slower gunboats at Split Rock, 18 miles short of Crown Point. The Washington, however, was too badly damaged and too slow to make it, and she was forced to strike her colors and surrender, with 110 men being taken prisoner. Arnold then led many of the remaining smaller craft into a small bay on the Vermont shore, which is now named Arnold's Bay, about 2 miles south of Button Mold Bay. And the waters here were too shallow for the larger British vessels to follow. Arnold ordered his boats to be run aground, stripped, and set on fire with their flags still flying. Arnold was the last to land. He personally torched his flagship Congress, and he and the surviving ship's crews, which numbered about 200 men, made their way overland to Crown Point, and they narrowly escaped a Native American ambush. Once at Crown Point, they found the Trumbull, the New York, the Enterprise, and the Revenge, all of which had escaped the British fleet, as well as the Liberty, which had gone down to Fort Ticonderoga and had missed the battle entirely. Arnold's convinced now that Crown Point will no longer be viable as a point of defense against the large British force. So he destroyed and abandoned the fort and moved all the forces and supplies stationed there to Ticonderoga. General Carleton, rather than shipping his prisoners back to Quebec, actually returned them to Ticonderoga under a flag of truce. And on their arrival, all the Continental men were talking about Carleton and how nice he was and how nice they had been treated while they were in British capture, etc., etc. I mean, they were talking about it so much that they were actually sent home so that what they were saying would not make other troops in the Continental Army want to desert. With control of the lake, the British landed troops and occupied Crown Point the next day. They remained there for 2 weeks, pushing scouting parties to within 3 miles of Fort Ticonderoga. The battle season was getting late as the first snow began to fall on October 20th, and Carleton's supply line would be difficult to manage in the winter, so he decides to withdraw north to winter quarters. Arnold's plan of delay had succeeded, even though the battle itself was a definitive defeat. Baron Reesdale, who commanded the Hessians in Carleton's army, noted that, "If we could have begun our expedition 4 weeks earlier, I am satisfied that everything could have ended this year." The Battle of Valcour Island is the first battle of an American Navy, and it's actually touted in American history as the first battle of the American Navy. And like I said earlier, it was a defeat, but it did serve to delay the British on their advance south. The battle took place in October. Washington would cross the Delaware, fight in Trenton and Princeton, in December of 76 and January of 77, so just a few months later. And this is what we've been talking about in the last three or four episodes. In our next episode, we're going to be moving forward to April of 1777, so after Delaware, Trenton, and Princeton, to discuss the Battle of Ridgefield, which also features our favorite traitor, Benedict Arnold. If you think that today's episode was worth a dollar or two, why not head over to the website and donate to support the podcast? Visit AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com and click on the green button that says Support the Podcast. There you'll be able to give recurring donations with Patreon or single or recurring donations with PayPal. The podcast is listener-supported, so every little bit helps, even if you just decide to buy me a cup of coffee every month. I'd like to thank my donors from this week. Zach pledged a recurring donation at the sergeant level. That's amazing and will definitely help support the podcast. Thank you very much, Zach. And Edward M. gave a one-time donation at the corporal level. And Brent also gave a single donation at the specialist level. Thank you, Edward and Brent, for your donations. And all of my recurring donors that have supported me this month, thank you for your donations. If you do donate, you'll get your name on the website and you'll be mentioned on future episodes. To stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Facebook and Twitter or with the email newsletter. Links to all of those are on the website, or you can search Facebook and Twitter for American Military History. Special thanks to all of my retweeters this week, at JerseyVapeGeek, at Morpheus43, at Ball16870, at JimYat11, at McKeel88, and at MLunyon. If you'd like the illustrious honor of having your Twitter name mentioned here, just retweet one of my tweets to your followers, and I'll read your name out. It's that simple. I got some really good reviews this week on iTunes. And guys, I know if you go out there and you just review it and you don't put any comments, I don't necessarily get to it. So if you've done that, thank you very much. If you have written comments, I like to, you know, say your names here on the podcast. This week saw five more five-star reviews in iTunes from Cody and Christy, that's one person, Ball16870, Tyrell Lloyd 2011, user 36526, and Pam Lewis. Thanks to all of you for reviewing the podcast. That brings us up to 41 total ratings at the time of this recording, and that is awesome. We are so close to our goal of 50. Let's see if after hearing this episode, if we can get 9 more people to go out and review the podcast. I just want to have two quick notes here before we wrap up. I've gotten a couple questions about the Navy itself and Dragoons. So let's handle the Navy first. Remember, and it's a little more encompassing than the Navy. As I said earlier, this battle that we talked about today is typically agreed upon to be the first battle of the American Navy. And I've had a couple of you ask me, you know, hey, Justin, you really haven't given any focus to the formation of the Navy or to the formation of the Marines, the Army, et cetera. Really, the only one that hasn't said anything yet is the Air Force, and that's probably because we're in the 1700s. You guys are right. I haven't. I have not sat down and talked about the history of those, but that is because I have a plan to do that after we get out of the Revolutionary War. So I don't want to do it kind of mixed into the episodes. I want to give all the branches the respect that they deserve. So once we get out of the Revolutionary War, you know, look for episodes that are going to be titled something like, you know, the history of the Navy or the history of the Marines. And we'll go from start to finish on those to kind of fill you in on, you know, their history. So I just wanted to throw that out there and let you guys know that that was coming. The second question I had was about Dragoons, and we talked about Dragoons in the Battle of Princeton. The British were using them, and the question was, what exactly are they? Really, it's just a fancy term for a cavalry unit. They fought on horseback, and typically they carried a sword or like a very long dagger for kind of hand-to-hand in close combat, and they would also carry either like a short-barreled rifle or a pistol of some type, sometimes even a long-barreled pistol, so that kind of blurred the line between rifle and pistol. But they would carry that, and they were used just like any other cavalry would be used in battle. So I hope that answers some of the questions that you guys have. Keep them coming. I really enjoy the questions and the feedback, and we'll address them here if we need to. That's all for this week. Next week, I will see you at the same time and same place. And once again, next week, we'll be hanging out with our most favorite trader, Benedict Arnold, but this time it will be at the Battle of Ridgefield. We'll see you then.